I firmly believe that we deserve, period.
I just feel like it's important to keep saying that out loud, that this is us learning in public.
The foundation of I Do Not Have Trash Politics is really just relationships, right?
So if you're not aware of how powerful you are, then how can you be using your power to bring others up?
We're giving you collective liberation. We're giving you personal healing. We're giving you millennial auntie with a mic.
You're listening to Seen, the podcast.
When we think about change, we have to imagine new horizons. Where are we even changing towards? Where are we going? Well, in this episode, we sit down with Mabrat Bayene. Mabrat is Eritrean, born in Ethiopia and raised in Montreal. She's co-chair of Living in Community and executive director of Wish Drop-In Center Society, the largest organization in so-called Canada that supports women and gender diverse people engaged in street-based sex work. Mabrat has worked in social justice, nonprofit management, community development, and initiatives related to health and safety for women for over 20 years. She served as ED of PeerNet BC and was the recipient of the 2020 YWCA Metro Vancouver Women of Distinction Award in the nonprofit category. She's also a mom, a choir nerd, an incredible singer, and a great friend of mine who I get to work with really closely as co-chair of the ward at Wish. In this episode, Lala and I sit down with Mabrat to talk about what it means after 20 years in the game to level up. She talks about her greatest accomplishment, what it means to seek support and appreciate our elders, and how our movements could benefit from an ethic of kindness and care. Take a listen. Okay, well, Mabrat, so grateful for you to be here on this fine day. And you mentioned that even in coming to this meeting, there's been, the universe has been creating some space for you to come here in a more, you know, grounded, maybe less frantic way. And I love that. And the first question that I have for you is, how is your heart? How are you doing? How are you finding your afternoon?
Oh, that's such a good question and such a hard question. So good to see you both and so good to be part of this podcast. As I fangirl both of you, and I get to fangirl Nick all the time because we get to work together more often. How am I doing and how's my heart doing? That's actually the second time somebody's asked me that question in that way in the last 2 days. Isn't that amazing? So I think mostly good. Working in the downtown east side kind of makes it hard, you know, to really say, yeah, great. But otherwise, I'm grateful for my health and that I'm here on my own 2 feet and all of the things.
We're talking about and exploring this topic of transformative justice for self. And we're having you all join us in conversation today to talk about, you know, these stages of growth and eventually getting to a place where in our personal lives and maybe even professional lives, we are feeling this need to level up. And so I'm really curious, how has the notion of leveling up felt relevant in your life? What areas in your life? How are you finding even that framing as timely or, you know, relevant at all?
I think it's very relevant and it's also timely for a number of reasons. One, I think that whole concept of leveling up, I don't know, raised by immigrant parents, where it was drilled into us that we had to be twice as good, sometimes three times as good as the white kids in our class or the white boys in our class. And so this whole thing of leveling up, I think, has just been ingrained into my DNA. And then I also think about it in terms of how women often talk about imposter syndrome and how we often are you know, worried that we're not actually performing or that we're not qualified to be where we are or that we're not skilled. And to a certain extent, I think that to me is also included in what we might define as leveling up. But the more positive side of it, I think of it as and this definitely applies both personally and professionally, I take it as the opportunity of like, what is it that we do well that we could be doing better or that we could be celebrating better? I think one of the things that I do poorly is actually celebrating the good things that have happened and actually taking a moment to be like, we just did a massive thing. And like, what if that was leveling up? You know, what if taking the moments to slow down and celebrate and go, this was really difficult and look what we just accomplished. What if that's what we defined as leveling up? What if that means we're giving space and time to big each other up and that's leveling up? But otherwise, I think I might struggle with that. I might struggle with it in terms of like always wanting to be perfect and delivering for everybody. And also the concept of being in service to others, which definitely has a shadow side to it. Yeah, I don't even know if that answers answers your question, but those are all the things that come up for me.
It is such a complicated thing. I'm glad you mentioned the shadow side of it. I want to dig more into that, but first I want to ask you, when have there been moments in your life that you knew you needed something more, that you felt maybe on the precipice of leveling up, or you felt like you saw the vision of leveling up? And I'm wondering where that feeling came from, that kind of knowing that something bigger was ahead.
Oh, wow. What a massive question. I think there's been moments, like if I think about my time here at Wish, there are moments of the sheer, you know, weight of the responsibility of the work. I think there's moments there of, you know, there are participants depending on us. There's staff depending on us. And I think sometimes there's moments of like, oof, this is important. There's important stuff to do. And there are people depending on us doing this job well. So I think that's probably a moment. There's been moments in this job that have been genuinely difficult and where I've realized, oof, I need to pull whatever together. I need to pull myself together more. Or I need to, you know, there's something more being asked of us and of me. So that I would say that would be one. But that's like a protracted one because I've been here for 7.5 years. 7.5 years. Probably the humility of becoming a mom is another one of, you know, I think everybody has preconceived notions about moments in life and, oh, I'll be this kind of a parent, I'll be this kind of a mother. And then just the sheer humility that's required of you once you realize, okay, this is more all consuming and more demanding. And again, another moment of like, ooh, the sheer responsibility of this, the weight of the sheer responsibility. That I think you could take it two ways, right? Of like, ooh, being paralyzed by the fear and the weight of that, or also reveling in it, that you get to shape a person, you get to be part of contributing to someone's contributions to this world. And that feels pretty exciting, but it also, I think, forces you to level up of, okay, I've got a model. Well, I can't be telling him one thing and living another way. I can't be, you know, that I think has been, I think that's probably the biggest one, really, that might trump all the other moments in life.
What I'm hearing you speak to, Mabrat, and I appreciate you mentioning the piece about like deconstructing this idea of leveling up as like, it's not just about moving on to the next thing and like success in that way. It also could and should look like taking stock of what we've done and what's gotten us here and reveling in it and honoring that. So I really appreciate that. And I wanted to go back to what you mentioned around like early ideas of what leveling up is, as like, because it's really relevant to me, this idea of like coming home with, I don't know, an assignment and it's like, it's 92%. And it's like, well, where was the 8%? Who at the top of the class? Like who, you know, that idea and that notion of like, you're always striving, you're always a work in progress. Perfection is actually the standard. I wanted to know in particular, like all of that, how that feels specific or particular being a Black woman and doing the work that you do, which is highly visible, which is in arguably one of the most impoverished and at the same time, like heavily surveilled, heavily serviced neighborhoods in so-called Canada, there's always so many eyes on what Wish is doing and what is happening in the downtown East Side. I'm just curious if you could kind of speak to what it's like in this body, being visible, having to hold all of this space, feeling responsible. What does it do to you? If you have any thoughts on that, I'm just curious because I, you know, we text sometimes and I'm like, how are you? And I would love if you could, yeah, share what you feel comfortable about what that leveling up means in the context of Black womanhood.
Yeah, which in this geographic context here in Vancouver, Lower Mainland, BC, is so, I think it's really challenging. There's this weird thing where as Black women, we are simultaneously hyper visible and also invisible. And I don't know if I've experienced that in many other cities or locations as I have in BC. Mm-hmm. I also have never encountered as much of the overt racism. Like, I was never called the N-word until I moved to this province. That had never happened to me directly until I moved here. So this weird, what I constantly see, and this, I mean, I think this drills down even in this work here. I constantly see, yeah, this visibility and invisibility of Black women. And then also this thing, there's like this weird fetishizing that'll happen of Black women. And I don't even mean sexually. I mean, even in terms of, okay, we now have a Black person here. We have a Black person on the panel. We have a Black person speaking on this thing. So therefore, this person is without fault. We're hearing the true, and you know, this is how Black people feel, and we get this bizarre approach around race because I think we're checking off people's boxes. Well, look, we've got a Black woman in the mix. That will sometimes just, I think, is a ridiculous checkbox, and then at the same time, there may be some hypervigilance on us also for being Black. I don't know if I'm quite explaining this well, but there's a weird thing that I've been trying to navigate living here in BC of what is, like, how are you invisible and visible and hypervisible at the same time? And so that means you're going back and forth between people questioning where you've gotten because maybe you only got there because you're Black and you're you know, people are desperately looking for diversity and checking diversity boxes off. And then the opposite, right, of also pushing back against us or maybe pushing back against our authority or our expertise because we're Black, questioning it, you know, and the resentment that might come up as well, which will translate into resentment over our authority or, you know, our experience. And then in terms of growing up, I don't know if I would have been prepared for this. Certainly. I don't know if I was prepared for this visibility, invisibility thing. I grew up back east in Montreal where the Black community was much larger. And it was a different form of racism, but it's been so bizarre to me to be fetishized and ignored at the same time. Like, how is it happening
at the same time?
And I don't mean, I mean, we could talk for hours about the sexual fetishizing, but I'm actually talking politically, socially, like this weird thing that happens around proximity to Blackness that people seem to love. I mean, they don't want to be us, but they certainly
love us. Certainly not.
Yeah. They certainly like to be around us and our, you know, culture and those kinds of things. So that is a weird thing to navigate. Of watching people do both things at the same time.
I wanted to jump in when you were talking about folks seeing you as like a checkbox on their diversity, you know, in that regard. It's almost like Black womanhood gets used as an institution's example of how they're leveling up. Like, look at us, now we are more diverse. And it's like trying to disrupt that relationship that for so long and in continuity keeps happening, that we are not like the magical Negro to come and like diversify or save the day. And yet as well, you do a lot to save the day. You know, it's like juggling that reality and recognizing that it's not just you, like you're part of a team, an ecosystem. And there's so many folks that have like supported you, invested in you, you know, and we'll talk a bit about that later. Lala, I'm wondering if you have any questions for Mabrat with respect to this piece about visibility, invisibility, and like that toggling back and forth especially from like a therapy standpoint. I'm curious if you think we have created enough space to talk about like that shadow side of like the higher up you go, you know, with more power, it can feel, I'm sure, lonely and isolating and like what that does. Well, I'm just curious if you have thoughts about this in general.
Well, yeah, the fact that you're bringing up that potential isolation or loneliness, that was the question that was really coming to my mind was, you know, you're navigating this paradoxical and heavily oppressive experience. And I'm wondering how you have experienced or how you have longed for support and community and mentorship as well. I'm wondering if mentorship is something that you've had access to as a Black woman in the kind of position of authority that you're in.
Yeah, such a great question. No, I don't think so. Certainly not here. What I've definitely craved in BC is like more of a cohort of us, right? I mean, like I have no illusions of my privilege. I have none whatsoever, right? And now that I'm 50, I also have privilege of age. And I was noting to some friends the other day the realization that I have been a boss longer than I have been bossed, right? And that does a thing to you as well, right? That the longer that you are in this type of a role, that absolutely does, you know, create blindsides and possible gaps, right? But I think the part that I'm missing for sure is the safety of a cohort of other Black women at this age, at this stage of career, where there's the opportunity to just really vent in a very safe way. And not just about these type of roles, but these type of roles as a Black woman. And it's been the same as I've been trying to find coaches, you know, and just even trying to explore the concept of coaching and on a professional level. I started to have to go and look to the US and to Toronto to try to find Black women coaches, and just how difficult that was. And then it's not the same on Zoom, right? It's not the same to maintain that type of relationship or that type of connection, but that there's so much lost in trying to seek support when the race and gender part aren't sorted. And just having enough space for a cohort of us to talk freely, often, candidly, more formally, all of the things. It feels like a real deficit in this land, in this space. And then when I do travel, when I do go to, you know, I always like to say real big cities.
I mean, you're not wrong.
Sorry, Vancouver. When I travel to other cities, I'm like, oh my God, look how many are here. And then I just see glimpses of what we're missing out here, and glimpses of what is so difficult to pull together as well, because everybody is stretched thin, and everybody, like, this would just be more work and more emotional labor for us to pull together, as opposed to, oh gosh, wouldn't it be amazing if we just lived in a place where there was a richness of us around and available, that it just happens organically.
I'm wondering around Mabrat, it doesn't sound like there's any sense of like fragility or ego attached to this desire for more support, more help, like a cohort of folks that you're able to sort of just like have as a soft place to land. And I'm curious about, like, when I hear you talk about this, I'm like, I love it, but I want to almost unpack it a little bit more, because there's something about being a Black woman in a world that is so comfortable humbling you that when people have told me in the past, like, one of your best attributes is your humility, I'm always like, what does that mean to you? Why do you be saying that shit to me? You know, it's really fucking weird. And I'm curious about what I'm sensing from you, this, there's no ego attached to asking for support or needing that, you know, cohort of folks. Has that always been the case? Like, where do you find yourself in terms of being comfortable asking for that support as you know that there are, you know, new heights, new horizons that you're trying to take an organization and also that you know you need for yourself on a personal level?
Like, yeah, I think the older I get, I am being way more intentionally transparent about the challenges. And I don't mean like, you know, airing the dirty laundry, but actually being realistic about how difficult this work is, being more communicative about where the gaps are and the challenges are in this type of sector, in this nonprofit sector, which is, I mean, you know, 30 years I've been in this type of work. So it's not as difficult anymore to ask for the help. I think earlier on, I was very aware of needing to make sure that all of my shit was together and that nothing showed on the outside, that I always had it under control, that I couldn't ever like accidentally slip into being an angry black woman, that I couldn't give anybody any fodder for like, you see, that's why she shouldn't be in that role. So that, you know, overperforming perfectionist thing. Oh yeah, absolutely. But I think the older that I get, I can see the disservice that we do to ourselves and to each other if we're not naming where we're struggling. And then in this sector, in this nonprofit sector, which I do, you know, love dearly, but we've got so much work to do in terms of how we function and how we martyr ourselves in the sector, individually, professionally, organizationally, community-wide, that there are a number of things around health, sustainability, and safety that really should be non-negotiable, but that we cut ourselves off at the knees in this sector, in this nonprofit sector. So there's a thing that I feel we have a responsibility about, of really naming how difficult some of this stuff is, and that to fix it actually requires quite a huge amount of investment, support, and so on. But to your question, I think in the thing that I'm discovering now is this other level of asking for support and then not getting it, mm-hmm. right? Or when you think you're being super clear about what are the areas of support that you need, when it doesn't come through, right? So it's like, okay, what's happening here? Is the ask too difficult? Is it too complicated? Is it too expensive? Was it not a real ask in the first place?
Are people listening to you? Like, do people understand?
Yeah, exactly. So that's been a new thing because that I'm aware of, because I've been taking time more recently, I'm talking like in the last 3 or so years, of really thinking about what is my ask? What actually am I asking for by way of support? And then if I take the time to really map that out, and then when somebody does ask me, and I'm like, okay, thank you for asking that. Here's what I need. but then where does that go? What happens with that is really interesting. So I think there may also be this parallel thing around, are we actually ready to provide people support when they ask for it? And if we talk about this sector, you know, then I see responsibilities for all of us, whether we're working on this side of funding or whether we are folks who are in control of funds and able to administer funds and grants, etc. How are we actually approaching that? Are we actually removing barriers or adding more barriers by the time somebody brings up, you know, has the courage to ask for support?
That's huge. I'm so glad that you're naming that gap. I feel like there's so much dialogue around asking people for support, or, you know, let me know if you need anything. And then the next steps after that are so overlooked.
But it's also that piece about sometimes when people need support the most, they actually can't articulate what help they need. Mm-hmm. There is that piece too, that we need to name, especially in this work, like any of us who are doing social justice work or direct service type social work, social services, how do we address that piece that in crisis, in this moment that this entire sector is feeling of extreme burnout and short staffing, asking the whole sector what they need is interesting. Again, are you ready for when the sector tells you, we need this, 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 and a lot of times it's the same calls to action as it's been for the last 15, 20 plus years. So why are you still asking that question if you're not prepared to provide the support, right? So I think about this in terms of what's society's responsibility to those of us delivering social services? What's government's responsibility? What are funders' responsibilities? And how dare people ask, how can we help the sector and then not follow through? So there's so many levels to this piece, including sometimes people may not even be ready to hear that question. There's just too much triaging happening.
Absolutely. That makes so much sense. From the micro to the macro. Mm. Yeah, I'm really glad you're naming this. So I was also thinking about how you named earlier on the ways that you felt the pressure, whether that's internal, I imagine both internal and external, to look like everything is together. And I'm thinking about your journey as you did level up in your career, in motherhood, in your life. I'm wondering how that silence impacted you, how you might have been so surprised, because there is such a kind of cultural silence around these things. It's obviously not just you. And so when we actually get to some of these levels, we often are so surprised. I've already started to experience it, you know, early on in my career, getting to a level where I thought when I got here, it was going to feel very different than it feels, and really not knowing what to do with that and not knowing sort of where to turn. And so I'm wondering, like, how maybe some of those markers, how they impacted you, how you coped without being able to access some of that support that you craved.
Wow, I don't know if I ever thought about it that way at the time, because it was simply, I think it always felt, and I was certainly raised this way too, that it feels self-indulgent to complain. Like, you got work to do. Nope. Pull yourself together. Woman up, you know? that kind of, you know, don't complain, just work harder is a whole thing that I think was how we were raised and sort of how, you know, what was expected. There's also the element of recognizing privilege and therefore, okay, well, you don't actually have as much to complain about, so pull yourself together and make this happen. Make this happen for other people because you're actually in a good space. You actually don't have much to complain about. That is really hard to counter, whether it's coming externally or whether you're doing it to yourself. I don't know if it, you know, necessarily negatively impacted me. I think it's just, I don't know, I just how I functioned, how I survived. The parts that I do think about, however, with regret, is what was it that I was modeling for others, including people who I was responsible for or supervising. Like, what's this thing that I was modeling inadvertently, and possibly as really bad examples of how to power through, how to just keep going, don't complain. So I think about that more. Yeah, more than anything else.
Do you think, Mabrat, in the thoughtfulness that you have, like, how did you impact others without even knowing, now that you know that the sort of woman power through, like, that's also impacted you? So you're like, oh shit, how did that show up in my work style, my leadership style, whatever? In that space of taking stock, do you find it easy or challenging to create space for compassion for yourself? Because to your point, you said before, like, this is what I did to survive, this is what I did to get through. And what I'm hearing you articulate is, you only know when you know. And then from this point forward, it's sort of like, well, now I want to be speaking up about this. Like, now I want to be naming the paucity of support, or that I actually don't know all the things, or even modeling, like, that it's like being imperfect happens, and like sometimes shit happens. And it's okay. So I'm just curious about that space of grace that it sounds like you're able to inhabit. What's that been like? What's that internal voice been like? I like to ask this question in particular because I've noticed in myself this change once I realized how getting up in the morning and being like, okay, bitch, let's do this, was not very kind. Like, it was funny, but it was like not the most gentle to me. And I'm curious if you've had any shifts in just the way that you, you know, think of yourself and see yourself. And yeah, if you could speak to that.
Right. And also that litmus test of if our inner monologue was someone else saying these things about us, would we just be shocked and be like, I can't believe she said that to
me
or about me? Yeah. Or, you know, would you let your friends be talked to that way, kind of? Yeah. That is a great question. I think one of the things I'm not good at is that some of that inner reflection, or that I sort of resist it at times. Again, that whole like, oh, you're being self-indulgent. Come on. Now pull yourself move on. You've got work to do. That I've struggled with forever. But I know I'm not alone. So that's that's one thing. Have I become more compassionate to myself? I think so. And I think this falls into the, what's the expression? I wish I knew then what I know now. I have so much more ability to say, I don't know about that, but I do know this, I'm really good at that, I'm really bad at that, and I'm much better at saying, I fucked that one up, whoa, did I fuck that up, whereas I would not have been able to do that before. And then also just sort of the audacity of youth, where you think you know everything. There's a thing that I've been reflecting on around how do we talk to ourselves? And how do we give ourselves some space for grace and compassion and forgiveness? There's something that I'm struggling with. I don't know if this is like a tangent or if this is relevant. I mean, like, it's connected in my head. I think about the elders in our movement when I was growing up, when I was like in my late teens and my early 20s. 20s, right? So this would be in Montreal. And if I'm thinking about those in the Black community, our elders in the Black community, we never thought, like, we didn't do that thing that I feel like is happening now, where anybody over 35 is just suspect and like you can't learn anything, you can't possibly learn anything from them, they're already too old, or maybe over 40, I don't know what the bar is right now. There's a thing that I think we're losing, where we're not figuring out a way to learn from our elders. And we're not allowing for space and grace even within our elders, like in terms of these movements. Like, everything in these movements are extremely cyclical, you know? Mm-hmm. And maybe the topics shift, and maybe the tone of things shift, but it's the same movements over and over and over again, or at least it's the same dynamics over and over again. And my point to that is there's still always something to learn. And I feel like there were moments of our communities helping us to check ourselves and check each other that doesn't quite exist now. And it feels as though there's pressure. I think there's actually worse pressure now for people to get it right 100% of the time, all the time, and that we're brutally freaking unflinching to each other. We're unflinching to people making mistakes and missteps. We're brutal to each other in this sector and on the left. So it's interesting that you're asking that question. Is there, like, you know, room and space for compassion? I think there's one element of it for ourselves, but we're not doing it well with each other. We're tearing each other apart on the left. And we're looking for spaces and moments and opportunities to, haha, they fucked up. We're going to cancel them. We're going to take them down. That is something like I've never seen before. And is so upsetting to watch. And so it's interesting that you're asking that question, because I feel like it's actually getting worse. I feel like we're doing a thing where maybe people are doing better on individual level, but person to person and within communities and within movements, I feel like we're being more brutal to each other than I've ever seen in previous generations of movement building. that I worry about. So like, then what does it mean? What does it mean for us individually if we're trying to find ways and spaces and places to be, to show each other and ourselves grace when we refuse to do it in movements and when we refuse to do it publicly? Whether it's performative or not, just looking for ways and places to cancel people when, you know, like, and what's the distinction of, what's the distinction between a misstep and opportunities for growth and reflection at an individual level and at a community level? And I wonder what that's doing to us individually and collectively, and what is that doing for our individual ability to forgive ourselves or be patient with ourselves and each other? If we could do that so easily to strangers, and sometimes not even strangers, like if we can do that so easily to people that we've been working alongside in the movement, and we can do that so easily to people, then what are we doing to ourselves? It's gotta be along the same spectrum of, you know, just brutality.
I completely agree. And I think it is so relevant to this conversation, because how do we grow? How do we level up? How do we expand what we're capable of if we don't have room for that kind of making mistakes, if we don't have room to sometimes fail and learn from that? And I think there's so many people who are naming what you're naming around that brutality, especially on the left. But I think it's really hard for us to know what to do with that. And especially with such a lack of mentorship, as you've spoken about. I'm wondering if there have been moments for you or certain spaces, maybe it's a relationship, maybe it's within spirituality, maybe it's something else. I'm wondering if you've had moments or glimpses of a different kind of compassion, a different kind of relating that feels more aligned with your values and what would feel supportive to you just as a human.
Maybe it doesn't bode well that I can't think of something right now. I'll share the one that just popped into my head. It's the choral community. So I'm a former choir member, have been for like years and years and years and years. And now I don't sing in choirs anymore, but I volunteer with a youth choir, which is such a nice way just to be around young people, music making. It's just beautiful. And also that I'm such a geeky fan of the metaphor of choirs, you know, of like literally multiple voices, different voices, divergent voices coming together to make beautiful music. It's so cheesy, but it's true. So I'm thinking about some of like what I'll see in some of the youth choral communities where they're super progressive and really engaged in their communities, but they're also deeply supportive of each other, and like unapologetically so, right? Those are nice glimpses, which for me are definitely respite from all the rest of the bullshit that happens in the day-to-day. And what feels like people just chomping at the bit to tear each other down, and then I just run away to, you know, the choir, and I get the respite there. And it's encouraging also because it's young people, so then, okay, then I get to be in this support role that is, I literally can just be around young voices doing beautiful things together. I think the only other moments are the being able to talk with other women executive directors, where we can be way more blunt, and we can just, because it's exact, you know, every organization is going through literally the exact same crap over and over again. There's no difference, right? You can just change out the name and change out the organization, change out the mandate. It's the exact same dynamics. It's the exact same scarcity. It's the exact same tensions. So there's a lot of, I think in our support of each other and like by that point, just the humor of venting and the humor of just, you know, that other person knows exactly, you don't have to explain. They know exactly what you're talking about. There's so much comfort in that. That might be it. That's really sad. I don't have any more examples, Lala. Or I'm not thinking about it well enough. I don't know. I would say, here's another thing too that I'm aware of, because I see it's not fully back, but we've just, you know, the last 3 years have just done a number on on our systems and structures of support, including all of the things that used to just organically happen because we were physically in the same places together. And what has 3 years of just Zoom engagement done to us, that I think we're going to be unpacking for, you know, decades at this point. Just what has this done? As an extrovert, I'm definitely seeing that it's harder to look for and find places of support that are genuine and that aren't performative. And also that just doesn't feel, this is now too much work, you know, it's like not actually helpful. It's not actually supportive. I don't know. I wonder if that's happening for more of us than we realize.
One thing that I wanted to, as we sort of wind down our conversation with Brett, is really validate what you mentioned around the brutality and the chomping at the bit to be so carceral, really, to one another. And for me, one of the really beautiful gifts of transformative justice is this recognition that the ways that we learn how to be in community with each other are rooted in the same systems that we're always trying to name and call out and fight against. And one of those systems is, you know, the carceral system. And like, how do we actually find our path through? So often, I think we struggle around creating space to recognize that, like you said, how we treat other people is oftentimes a mirror of how we treat ourselves. And I find it really not even discouraging, but a big challenge, like you said, on the left is going to be like, how do we want to relate with each other? How do we want to work with each other? How do we want to sustain this, all the movement work that we are so committed to doing? How are we allowing our values to shine through even when things get really fucking hard? Because that's where it matters the most. It matters okay or just fine when, you know, things are great. But like when things are really tough, how are we going to model the compassion, the empathy, the care, the social justice, which requires our ability to like humanize each other and not dehumanize each other to the point where we're saying like, because you made one mistake, now you are completely unsalvageable. You are completely trash. Like I don't want to be in a space with you, right? Like so much of the language that I've heard and that I'm guilty of using in particular, especially in the past, has been so, like it's been so rooted in disposability. And I think what you're describing is, don't we want more for each other? Like, certainly we do. At least intellectually, we know that that's what we wish for. And so there's something challenging about, you know, merging what we know intellectually when it comes to our values and the things that we sort of, you know, beat our chests about with our actions when the rubber hits the road and shit's actually really fucking hard. And I don't know what the path through is, but I just know that, yeah, we do struggle on the left in progressive spaces with like reconciling those things. And that's why I think transformative justice offers such a helpful framework for thinking about not just like restoring like people who have like one person has committed harm and, you know, taking care of the person who's been harmed, but like transforming the conditions that allowed for the harm to happen, which means we also have to think about like, how are we reproducing these carceral systems that we're saying we're opposing with each other all the time? So I just wanted to speak to that. And also, like, I guess as a closing question, what do you want to sort of leave us with when it comes to your journey, your, you know, the things you have accomplished and want to go toot toot? Because I know you said you're not that good at doing it. And I want to give you the opportunity to do that on this podcast. Like, what are you proud of? What has been some examples of you leveling up in ways that are, you know, big, small, all of that?
Oh my gosh, what a great conversation. Yeah, and all those questions that you had around the disposability of our sector and this and the left. Wow, that's such a great framing. What am I proud of? It's my kid. I'm gonna knock on wood here. He's turning into this really wonderful human that is kind and like learning his way in this world. And I think the way some of his instincts feel really good. He's this awesome kid, you know. I'm like, yes, clearly I'm biased, but I honestly, I think of him as that if he wasn't mine, I would still like him. Because there's, you know, you love your kids because you have to love your kids. But I'm like, I actually like him too. So that I, not that it's all me for sure, but I'm really proud of him, and I'm proud of the contributions that I've made that are part of who he is. And I can't wait to see who he further becomes, and, you know, what he accomplishes, and whether, you know, I'll, you know, there'll be elements of this kindness that I'm craving that will be in him, and that maybe he starts to help create some of these spaces that we're all talking about. Yeah, I think that's really the big one, because everything else I would be like, I'd be like, my perseverance, my stubbornness. Like, okay, those aren't, those are more shadow things, but, but really, I just think of him and sort of what's going to be possible, and what he might do, right? What he might do as a result, and what he might contribute in whatever way he identifies to contribute to our communities and our society is exciting to think about. Knock on wood. And then I think the other thing is I'm being way more vocal about concepts of kindness as maybe being at the root of everything. That if we could at least center kindness, and then what does that look like, right? Like, just can we center kindness? And if we can practice that, like, what does it actually feel like to be kind? And it's such a simple concept, but honestly, like, just try kindness first. Just try that. That's, I think, just me trying to be as overt in as many places and spaces to talk about kindness as one of the core guiding values or principles. And I like that I'm being, you know, the older I get, I like that I'm being more explicit about that and naming that of like, no, that's just shitty behavior. You're just being shitty. You're being shitty to yourself. You're being shitty to each other. And what does kindness look like instead? What if you practice that? Even half as much as we practiced
cruelty, whatever else.
Exactly.
A lot to be proud of, a lot to celebrate. I'm really happy that we're leaving on that note. And thank you so much for making time for us today, for sharing your experiences, for sharing your wisdom. It's been really nourishing to speak to you. So very grateful.
Thank you. And hopefully I wasn't too much of a Debbie Downer there in the middle. But yeah,
never.
A real pleasure to speak to both of you. Thanks for asking me.
Oh, thanks for being part of this, Mabrat. I knew it was going to be a lovely conversation, and I was right. So happy about that. Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed that conversation with Mabrat and have so many things that, on like a very personal level, I took note of, and I think I will be kind of reflecting on and coming back to, because this is an area that both fascinates me, like leveling up and what it means to sustain growth and what it means to be able to ask for some, like all of these things that she was mentioning are things that I struggle with. And so for one, I guess I'm curious to ask you, how did our conversation with Mabrat relate to where you are at in your career? I know you had mentioned recognizing or coming to a point in your therapy work where you've accomplished things and you had certain ideas as to how you're going to feel, and then come to find out like, oh, it's not what I expected. So I'm just curious of, given where you're at in the work that you do, what stood out and what felt the most, you know, resonant or applicable to your own life and experience?
So much of it. I think it was so helpful hearing her talk about the ways that we maybe feel pressure and put pressure on ourselves to put forth a particular image, and we're struggling beneath that, but feel like we can't show that. I think she talked about that being a really powerful force for her when she was younger. And I've definitely felt that as well. Like, I should know what I'm doing. I should feel confident. I should put on this face and not let people see how it really feels. And I think her talking as well about the craving for support, you know, the craving for peer support, the craving for mentorship, that really resonated so much for me. And I know I've talked to other racialized executive directors of nonprofits, and a very common theme is we're all like, this is so hard. It's so hard to be in the system. It's so hard to jump through all these hoops and try to figure out how are we supposed to get the funding and how are we supposed to make all of this work. Mm-hmm. And it would be so much better, I think, if we had more of that community. But for so many reasons, including some of those things she talked about, including, you know, putting forth this face as if everything's fine, including the ways we tear each other apart. Mm-hmm. It's so hard to find that.
Mm-hmm. I found it really interesting when she was talking about like the journey of motherhood and how that's created this opportunity for her to reflect on the responsibility of like taking care of a child and modeling behavior and showing up for somebody that's not herself. And she mentioned humility as this aspect of learning and a part of her journey that's really helped her, I guess, better reflect on, am I going to be in like full-blown paralysis about the enormity of this responsibility, or am I going to try to revel in it? And I really appreciated that almost fork in the road. And sometimes I'm straddling both forks. Like I'm on both sides of like, sometimes it is so the task ahead, the work ahead is just much greater than ourselves. And at the same time, I really love the way that she offered her own recognition that the celebration and being able to revel in what you've accomplished should be part of leveling up, but so often it's about perfection and perfectionism and, you know, that experience of being a child of immigrants and feeling that pressure of like needing to be three times as good as the white kids in order for you to just like be valid or accepted or be doing, you know, okay or good enough. So I wanted to say I appreciated that differentiation. And two, I wanted to say that I think the piece about humility that really resonated with me is about, as we are on this journey of growth or of healing or of increased responsibility, I think one of the most important aspects of that is that recognition of your own power and privilege, which she articulated a lot of, that it's not just about like that she needs to be perfect or that she needs to do a lot of work, but that people are depending on you. And I think that that's an important thing in the context of transformative justice, because it's not just about us on an individual level. Like we're talking about transformative justice for self, but we're also always connecting it to like, what are our responsibilities to the collective? What are our responsibilities to those we're in connection with or in community with? And that has to begin with like a reflective appreciation of how we're not islands unto ourselves, even though the shit might be really isolating. The reason why it's so isolating is because it sounds like, and I'm testing this with you, there's so much work to be done and there's still so many expectations and sort of like structures around how we expect one person to be like the hero or one person to sort of be like the one who has all the answers. When in actuality, that's not it. People need help. People need support beyond themselves. So that's something that came up, all those pieces came up for me. And I'm curious if that piece around like asking for help and wanting support and wanting connection and wanting or craving a cohort of people around you is something that you have asked for from others and not received, similar to Mabrat's experience, or just like, yeah, what's that been like for you in asking for help and receiving it or not receiving it? And where does that find you?
It's so difficult, honestly. I don't know. I think there has been times where I have asked for support and found it, definitely. Many times I've been very fortunate. And I think there's also been many times where I haven't, and where it's been maybe offered, but then taken away. Like, I don't know if the person maybe was overextending when they even offered, or if they just ultimately weren't able, something changed, or they weren't able to fulfill that. And it's so hard to even know where to look sometimes. I think it reminds me, I'm just thinking about Harsha as well, talking about being embedded in community and that reflexive relationship that can happen when you are so responsible to community. But I think there's so many of us who, especially in this age of smartphones and in this age of the pandemic, really don't know how to create that community offline. And like really don't know where to look for it. Does that resonate with you at all?
Yeah. Are you speaking to like the gap between the things we might post about online versus like how we might actualize it in real time with each other, and that being part of the big question mark?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people find a lot of, you can get a lot of social interaction sort of online. And I think people are a lot more comfortable with that now. And I think that's a great thing. I think it allows us to find each other in ways that we wouldn't have been able to before social media. And it allows us to hear each other's voices so much louder than we would have before social media. And also, I think when it comes to finding and building community completely away from socials, like face-to-face, it was probably always difficult. Like, I'm not trying to romanticize before the, you know, the internet, that I think there were a lot of lonely people then too.
Right.
I just think maybe sometimes there is a bit of an illusion because we feel like we're getting some social interaction, even just by like watching videos on TikTok. It's like, it registers almost right as like a human interaction, which is great to have that option. And also I think might sort of serve as a little bit of actually a barrier in some ways to finding other kinds of community.
I feel like I've noticed that there is a distinction between like social networks and like what is happening on social media versus what might be happening in, like, for me, the day to day, week to week, month to month contributions, connections I'm making with other human people. And I think that I have gotten to a place where I can appreciate what social media can do for me and the things that I still need beyond it to satiate and support me in my human interactions and my human needs. Mm-hmm. And I think that with respect to like the work that you do that's visible, the work that like the work that people do that is visible in general, I think that we've gotten a lot more comfortable interacting, like you said, on socials, and less comfortable having and holding space for the human nuance of what it means to be, for example, a woman of color who is disabled, who's at the helm of an organization that has visibility, that has a podcast, like that there's so much more that cannot be distilled from this podcast or from an Instagram post. And when we don't have an appreciation of that nuance, I think it's so much easier to look at you, for example, and be like, this is who Lala is. And it erases the complexity of your experience, the fact that, like, yes, you have privilege and power in the positional authority that you hold, for example, and yet also there are real day-to-day struggles that you navigate through. And I wonder if that contributes to the isolation in particular, if folks are at the helm of organizations or at the face of an organization or highly visible yet also invisibilized, right? Where it's like, I think that sometimes social media can play a really beautiful role in adding that complexity, but that's not without effort. And like, if we choose to sort of put ourselves out there, right? So yes, there's a choice in how we want to present ourselves, but also that's a lot of labor. And I think without the nuance, like I mentioned, it can be too easy for folks to be kind of hypercritical, not asking questions from a place of genuine curiosity and care, not offering support from a place of real grounded capacity, but perhaps it's from a place because we're so used to saying and doing things and then closing our phones and not, you know, not following through that perhaps that's also an element. I wonder if that's also an element of sort of, like you mentioned before, asking for support and having it sort of winding up with nothing in return. I'm curious if that resonates with you. I'm curious also of like, the ways that you have navigated the pressure from community versus the pressure on yourself, and which form of pressure feels most challenging or most difficult to sort of appreciate and embrace, and how, yeah, you are taking care of yourself amidst the pressure to run an organization, run a practice, care for you, be, you know, have relationships with other, like, just like, how do you balance those pieces? Because from what Mabrat was saying, a lot of my takeaway from her comments on like, oh, there are things I just didn't think about, like I just powered through, I know you'd be thinking a lot. And so I'm curious of how that piece in particular resonates, just balancing it all.
Well, it's so difficult. And I think there's such a gap for so many of us between what we say and what our ideals and values are and how we actually put that into practice. Mm. So I think conversations around perfectionism are very common. Like, who hasn't thought about perfectionism?
Right.
And I don't think anybody thinks, well, I'm sure somebody people do. Yeah. But most of us, and especially, you know, with our anti-oppressive values, I think most of us are not looking at perfectionism and thinking that's a great model for how to live my life.
Right.
I think we're challenging that. And even what Mabrat was talking about around the ways that we really tear each other apart for any mistakes or missteps or just not being perfect. I think increasingly, there are so many conversations about that too. Mm. And yet, all of this behavior continues and we don't connect these things too, right? It's like sometimes I understand why people might want to criticize work that's being done. And I think that can be really important. And I don't think that, you know, if there's anti-oppressive work being done and it's falling short in some ways, I don't think that people should just shut up about it, of course.
Right. Yeah.
And also, I think sometimes people maybe aren't going to realize, like, maybe you see an organization and you don't realize that from a day-to-day standpoint, that organization is one person. It's like one queer, disabled, like, woman of color.
Yeah. You're talking and about you. Maybe you don't know it's Lala. Yes.
Yeah. And there is only so much I can do. I am exhausted.
Yeah, you came on this call and said that.
Yeah, and feedback is very valuable. And also, how can we have a more collaborative spirit? How can we have a more compassionate spirit? How can we be in community more so it's not just yelling at each other online and ripping each other apart? It's actually like, let me be in community with you. Like, let's hold this together. Like, let's, how can we move forward with this? It's very different, but I think it's not necessarily obvious to any of us how to actually achieve that. And I don't know if some places are different. I mean, Vancouver is very notorious for being very unfriendly, right? Yeah. So it's very difficult to figure out sometimes how to be in community with people that we might want to be in community with. And I'm sure there's similar struggles in many other places, but So it's not obvious to me. I don't want to be that person either, being like, you people are doing criticism wrong and how dare you, you're horrible right. people, right? It's like, that would be the same thing if I were to sit here and say that as well. It's like, it's not obvious how to figure this out.
Yeah. Certainly, I know the things that don't help. I think, I feel like it's so interesting talking to you, talking with Mabrat, being in connection with so many other folks who are doing really heavy lifting in not in isolation, right? Like Mabrat is at the helm of an organization and has like a stellar team and, mm-hmm. and has amazing people who contribute their time and energy and brilliance. And yet I think that there is a real, like Mabrat was saying, and like you're alluding to and mentioning quite explicitly, this gap between how we wish, you know, our relationships with each other looked and actually functioned and what we're doing on a day-to-day basis that actually negates the former from even being possible. And I don't have the answers, but I definitely feel more and more protective of folks who are in sort of highly visible and highly responsible positions in community who I'm friends with or who I know. And I wonder oftentimes about just like who is reaching out and saying like, hey, how are you feeling? How are you doing? How is your heart? I have feedback for you, but like, let's talk, like, let's have connection first. Let me, like you said before, see this as an opportunity for me to give you something. And it's not just feedback, but it's my time. It's not just saying, here's a problem that I'm having. It's like, here's maybe some solutions. I'd love to talk to you. Here's how I want to contribute to making things better. You know, I think that so often, because we are in an age where we are so reliant on and have been able to rely on social media almost to the point where we don't really value talking with each other on the phone or in person or in an in a way that's not asynchronous communication. I think that we miss a lot of the just like how we impact others, even if we're right and the other person is wrong. In my being right, I hope to God that I don't come across as self-righteous, because mm-hmm. that alienates the other person that I'm hoping will correct their wrongness. How do I communicate that? And, you know, so much of it just feels like it's, yes, it's about being anti-oppressive and allowing your anti-oppressive values to be embodied in real, like, tangible action. And that also means, like, recognizing how we communicate to each other is just so void of real care and concern and respect. And that's the part I think that makes my heart hurt a lot sometimes, where I'm like, I've seen some emails that we've talked about, some things that have come across your desk. You know, there have been things that I've been able to chat with Mabrat about. There have been things that I've talked with lots of people about with respect to the ways that people communicate to them or about them or whatever. And it's like, I just wish that we held, like Mabrat said, like kindness, care, a desire for further communication after this one communication to happen, not just like, here's some fucking shit you should know. Boom. Like, let me tell you something. And then that's it. And you're kind of left with, okay, I now feel completely disrespected and I'm wrong apparently to this person. So I'm not only am I a fool, but I'm a wrong fool. Like, it's just, it's not fertile ground for transformation.
Well, this is the thing. And so no wonder it's so difficult for us to level up as individuals and as a collective, because I think in this perfectionistic, uncompassionate, harsh model, we may be able to achieve some sort of growth, but it's like destructive growth. It's, you know, think capitalism, think colonialism. Sure. You're accumulating right. wealth. You are expanding your empire, but it's in a way that is destructive to you and to people around you and to the earth and all of that. I think in order for us to grow in a way that is sustainable in a way that is life affirming, in a way where we can all rise together, requires so much more compassion. It requires something that is, it's so different. So there is this app called Curable that I use for chronic pain management, and they have this model of perfectionistic healing versus compassionate healing. And I think we can also think about this in terms of growth as well. And when it's perfectionistic, it's like you put forward effort towards this healing or towards this growth. And then whether you get results from that or not, if you get results, you're like, okay, this is working. Let me put in 5 times the effort. Or if it's not working, you think, okay, this isn't it. Like, I have to try 5 times harder to find something that, you know, will work, so I'm not failing. And either way, you're burning yourself out. And then that just leads to worsened symptoms, whether that's chronic pain, whether it's stress, whether it's exhaustion, whether it's, and then there's all the ways that we also react when we're under stress. Mm-hmm. Many of us become quite hostile to each other because we're under stress, because yeah. we're so depleted, mm-hmm. or we're hostile to ourselves in those conditions, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this whole collapse. Versus in a compassionate model of healing or compassionate model of growth, if you put forward effort and you get results, that's great. And you can maybe take a moment to rest, and then maybe you'll put in a little bit more effort, and then maybe you'll have a setback. And then you can just say, okay, so there's a setback. Let me rest. Let me take care of myself. Let me kind of regroup, and then I'll put forward some effort again. Or if you don't get any results at all, same thing. You rest, you take care of yourself, you just accept that, you regroup, and you can keep trying. And that is something that doesn't just lead you to this edge where you're burnt out and, you know, you can't function anymore. It's something right. where you can stay in the process. And I think that's so important for us as individuals, and it's so important for us in community to figure out, like, what are the ways that we can put forward effort and energy towards growth where we can stay in the process. Yeah. It's not going to lead to the burnout. It's not going to lead to these huge conflicts where we then fall out and never speak to each other again. It's, we can stay in the process. Like, that is the key. And we're never going to be able to really win as individuals or as communities if we can't stay in process with each other.
Yeah, it reminds me of that phrase of, like, moving at the speed of trust and creating, as we are in process, like, the conditions that allow people to press pause, to take a breath, to renegotiate what their boundaries might be, to have learning and to integrate that learning into how we do, which means we're gonna end up making some mistakes. Like, that there's something about our proclivity to getting there immediately, everything being 0 or 100. And there's, I think, maybe less tolerance of how long change and transformation and growth and healing take lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And the cyclical nature of that growth, healing, transformation, and the ways, like you're talking about, like, how do we actually sustain what we want to be true and real and actualized? That means that we have to recognize the very, like, humanity of other people as well as ourselves. Because to Ma Brat's point, she mentioned, and we all kind of agreed, I recall, just the fact that the ways that we treat other people are oftentimes a reflection of the ways that we treat ourselves. So it's like, how are we, what are we expecting of ourselves? And therefore, what are we expecting of others? And how can we generate more space and maybe even nuance or whatever it might be for different versions of success or different versions of growth or different versions? Like, I don't think, and in particular, I don't think that there's always one linear way. I don't think that we all have the answers. I don't think that for those of us who spend all of our time in critique mode, that we are also cultivating the conditions that address the issue that we want other people to solve the problems for. Like, it's really easy, I know, because I've been that person, to be like, you're not doing what good enough. This is how you should be doing it better. And it's like, well, how am I pulling my sleeves up and getting in the fight too? Because actually, many hands make light work, right? It's not just about telling other people how they need to be doing things better. It's about recognizing that that's actually my responsibility as well. And it's, yeah, I appreciate that framing of like perfectionist healing versus compassionate healing. And I feel like a lot of us struggle with seeing and treating others with compassion, especially folks who are in any positions of perceived power. And I think that in particular, in the work that we are doing collectively, should change. Like, I think that is a huge space where we can maybe think about how it is we wish others would treat us if we were in those same positions. And I wonder if a lot of the critique and the sort of perfectionist expectations also come from a place of just not knowing and understanding what it's like to have that much responsibility and visibility. And it's actually from a lack of understanding or knowledge or experience or all these things. And it's like, how can we create compassion in both directions to give folks the information, give folks the insight? But it's sort of like one has to start, like we have to start somewhere. And it's kind of hard to be a person that is expected to pull a bunch of amazing rad shit off on a dime and have all these expectations thrown your way and then feel like you can't fail. And then when you say you need help, people are like, aha, see, you don't know what you're doing. Like, there's just, it's a kind of weird, like you mentioned to my brat, like a paradoxical cycle where it's like, you're visible, but you're invisible. The expectation is you do everything, but you should be able to ask for help. But how would you ask for help if the very nature in which folks orient towards you is that you should know everything or you should be doing everything? It just doesn't seem healthy.
Yeah. And that also gets at what I felt when I was younger or less experienced, definitely, was people in these positions just know what they're doing and have it together. Right. And then you get there and you don't. And then you think it's because there's something wrong with you, not realizing that no, nobody actually really knows or fully has it together.
Right.
But I think so much of where we all as a collective need healing is in the relational. Yeah. I think our culture is so destructive relationally, and I think we have so little sort of skills training in that regard. Girl. That we yeah. just come at each other in all kinds of ways in our personal and, you know, community spaces and professional lives. And I think that is where we need so much healing, is figuring out what are actual better ways to approach ourselves and to approach each other with this compassion, where we are able to stay in relationship with each other. I mean, I think people maybe, it's a little bit easier for people to realize, not everybody, but like with, for example, like an intimate partner, if you just constantly criticize and attack them, is that good for your relationship?
Mm-hmm.
It's not ever good for any relationship, but we right. in these other scenarios seem to think that that's okay. Yeah. And it also brings me back to what my brat was saying around motherhood and around, okay, I have to actually live these values because my child is watching me. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what it would be like if we all took that, not just parents and not just in the presence of our children, mm-hmm. but in our lives more generally. What if we all lived that way of, I need to figure out first how to align my actual values and how I behave and how mm-hmm. I treat people and how I am in the world. I think that would be a really great starting point to transform what it feels like to be in community with each other.
Couldn't agree more. I also really appreciated the ways that she framed the issues that she's experienced in our progressive spaces on the left about just being really vicious and sort of like harmful and carceral to each other. And I took that as we are in greater visibility, as we have more responsibility, as we are leveling up, as, you know, as things in our life are shifting and changing, how are we seeing ourselves as also responsible for leaving the place, the space, the community, our connections better than the way that we found them? Mm-hmm. Like, how are we seeing ourselves? You know, people talk about being a good ancestor. Mm-hmm. And I can't recall who introduced that sort of language.
Layla Saad, I believe.
Thank you. I see that as a really important aspect of the conversation with respect to leveling up, because I don't want folks to walk away, or us to walk away, thinking it's about people being nicer to folks who have or are in positions of power, right? It's like, it's
no.
If that's what you take away, my God, let's please rewind. But I do think it is really important to see ourselves as models of how we want others to engage, how we want others to think, how we want others to behave, how we want others to humanize one another. Like, it does, there is a lot of pressure, and maybe this adds to it, or maybe this gives us the oomph, but like, that we need, hopefully. But it can start with us. Like, it can start with our ability to recognize, like, if I crave mentorship, if I crave support, how am I being a mentor and supportive to others who are coming up, or who are maybe don't even know that they need mentorship or support? Like, how am I building that bridge or that connection so that folks know that I'm available for that if they ever need? And I think that that framing is important, because too often, like I said before, it's always somebody else's responsibility. It's always somebody else that should be doing better. It's always somebody, it's like, how are we seeing ourselves as part of, even in really small ways, those solutions? So yeah, that was one big thing that I wanted to name, and I feel really grateful for that. And I guess I'm wondering if you have any closing thoughts on our conversation with Mabrat that stood out for you.
What's staying with me is that reflection on how are we showing up for each other? How are we creating longevity? Like, how are we treating our elders? How are we thinking about our elders and understanding them as not only flawed, but also survivors, you know, yeah. People who have made it this far? And how can we build these stronger community ties and relational ties that will lift all of us?